Yeah, it's not the years, it's the mileage. Anyway, moving on dexterously, we now await the awesomeness that isn't the official arrival of Emily Boston. How are you, Emily?
I'm good, thank you.
Marvellous. But it is the weather report for Lincoln, England, from Gibraltar, just off Spain. Off you go, Gabriella.
Okay, so the weather for Lincoln today is highs of 7 degrees centigrade, lows of minus 1 degree centigrade, and it's a fresh, breezy day with sleet showers.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
And the weather actually in Gibraltar is a little bit warmer, I believe. It's just a tad, really.
Yeah,
20 degrees warmer.
21 degrees high with 12 degrees low, and on average it'd be about 19. So very warm for this time of year, but we've had a very warm January and February, so I'm not exactly surprised.
Could be unseasonably so. This evening's Flare from Mountains to Molecules, we'll be talking all about cli-fi, climate fiction, and indeed climate change, and the notion that, well, maybe things are changing, and maybe not. I don't know. That could be the end of the world. Still, we've got a Midweek Drive Morning Edition to actually get through. Gabriella, have you spoken to David Fox before? I think you must have, because David said, I always like the lady from Gibraltar. It's marvellous, very polite. You know, probably happy.
Oh, thank you.
Exactly. So, David, back with us. What sort of things have you been doing since you last demonstrated some awesome magic on the programme a matter of weeks ago?
Well, it's lovely to be back again, Alex. Thanks for having me on today. It's nice to see, of course, Catherine and Emily here, too. We haven't met before, and obviously good to hear Gabriella, too. Just, I've been quite busy with weddings and parties, and up in Sheffield tonight at the Crown Plaza. For a charity evening, which will be, I'm looking forward to. That'll be a nice, nice one. But how are you, Gabriella?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I'm I'm doing all right, and the weather's nice, so I'm happy.
And according to the Gibraltar Chronicle, travel, health and the economy, the wide-ranging impact of coronavirus. Is this something that you're concerned about? Is it a case of, no, we're Gibraltarians, we're immune to everything apart from Brexit?
No, of course, Gibraltar's just as concerned about it as I think the rest of the world, and I'm sure even people in Lincoln as well. We have a border, we have a lot of tourists coming in and out, we have
an airport,
and we have a very small, very populated, we live in a very small populated area. So it's kind of a bit of a recipe there, but we are worried about it. I think a lot of people are.
Well, let's just test that.
I know that some say that it's just the flu, but because it's new, it's slightly more scary, I think.
Just because it's new doesn't mean it's not flu. Could be a little poetry line from everybody. Catherine Dove, are you worried about the coronavirus?
Not especially. I think I'm more worried for kind of friends who have asthma and things like that, but I'm generally in all right shape, so I think I'll...
And you're from Stevenage, so you're immune in any case.
Exactly. I'm immune to all sorts that you've probably never even heard of.
Precisely. Emily, on the other hand, Lord above, where do we start?
I think at first I wasn't worried about it, but now more cases are being confirmed. I'm the same as you. I've got family and friends who are weaker immune system, so I think for that reason I would be worried, but, I mean, I'd be fine, I hope.
And David, you know, Nottingham based, you know, Glasgow born and connected from that. So is it a case of no? You know, once you build that immune with porridge, all's well.
Well, this is very true, Alex. But like Catherine and Emily have said, obviously you're concerned about people who are they have weaker immune systems, they have an ongoing health condition. It seems to be them that have. Succumbed to the virus up till now, so obviously that's a concern. But hopefully it won't. It's not been declared as a pandemic yet, I believe. So.
Only a matter of time. You're listening to the positive thinking world of the Midweek Drive Morning Edition here on Siren Radio, Lincoln's first community radio station. We talked last night, obviously, Gabriella, about Lent, and we talked about being positive for Lent and working through that process. It was Ash Wednesday, of course, yesterday. Any thoughts from yourself? I noticed that Gibraltar Chronicle has actually sort of got a photo shoot in terms of the marking of Ash Wednesday.
Yeah. Which
is wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, every year a photographer goes and attends and takes pictures of everyone getting their ashes.
Well, remember, ashes thou were born and ashes to which you will return. You know, the dust to dust, ashes to ashes, that's pretty much it. Not just a song by David Bowie, an actual fact of life. We are star stuff. There we are. Yeah, I just like to throw that in there. Exactly. A pause for thought in the whole sort of cosmic sort of universe in which we live, a dot within a dot within a dot within a dot, and so on. But have you actually done anything for Lent? Do you intend to do anything for Lent? Or is it a case of, no, I've decided to actually sort of do something completely different?
No.
No.
I haven't planned anything. No. I did pancakes. I did Shrove.
Yeah, that's not Lent, though.
I mean, so I did the good stuff and haven't done the giving up.
By definition, you know, Lent starts on Ash Wednesday, then 40 days of preparation. Shrove Tuesday, pancake day, Mardi Gras, whatever, Day of the Dead. That's a different line entirely, you know. Anyway, never mind. It's worth it.
I haven't done anything this year. I haven't actually for the past few years.
Never too late to start. Emily, any questions for Gabriella?
I'm trying to think. I've not spoken to you for quite a while, Gabriella, actually. Have you got anything
it's
interesting?
It's not Gabriella's fault. She's in regularly, week in, week out.
I know. I'm normally in the evening the night before. Yeah. So, Gabriella, have you got anything interesting coming up this weekend that you wanted to fill us in on?
Oh, not this weekend, but I've got something interesting this morning. So I'm meeting Lauren, who works for the communications in the university. Mm. So we're going to have a catch-up because the University of Lincoln was in Gibraltar, as they had the university's fair on Tuesday night, so they attended the university and they told everyone about what a great uni it is and to go.
Splendid, splendid, marvellous. Yeah. On message, that's what we like to see. It's always very important. Okay, Catherine, last two questions for Gabriella, please.
Have you had a reasonably enjoyable telephonic link with us this morning?
I have, thank you.
Good, and will you be joining us again?
Hopefully next week I'll be back here.
She's right. Relentless, really. I mean, that's the series, really. It's week in, week out. You know, coming up to 9:09 in Gibraltar. Don't worry, it's 8:09 in Lincoln, England, and the rest of England as well, as far as we're concerned. last night on the Midweek Drive, as Catherine Dove will attest to, we had a general sort of consideration about how we should actually refer to the current Prince Harry. Obviously, he no longer wants to be referred to as Prince Harry, so I suggested maybe Hazza, and then maybe Hazza Baby would be good from that point of view, because he does. I think it's fair to say, Catherine, that we were trumped in many ways, no pun intended, by, of course, our correspondent there, in Wales, in fact, who specifically said he would maintain he should actually be referred to as Hazza Bin.
Yeah.
Hazza Bin, you know, Hazza Bin. It's great, you know. It's the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it, Richard Fitzwilliams? Really, it's just wonderful. Liz Brewer, you might be interested to know, our mutual colleague and friend, she was saying last night that about 2 or 3 decades' time, they'll regret what they've done. That was Liz Brewer's sort of take on the whole system. So there we have it.
It is possible, but whether... I rather doubt she will.
Ooh.
Of course, I don't know. I mean, nobody knows. He is certainly, the business of Call Me Harry. Well, it jumps the gun by rather a while, because after all...
Surely, the precedent for... given that Prince used to be referred to as the artist formerly known as, then Harry should actually be referred to as, you know, the royal formerly known as...
I think people are getting a bit tired of lengthy statements on websites, writing at the palace. The point is, of course, he's Prince Harry until the 31st of March, I'm afraid, so that's that. But on the other hand...
Will there not be a period of transition after that, then, for another...
This is, of course, a thing, one of the things they deeply resent. They don't like the period of transition. Mm. Other royals, they say, haven't had to go through it. They don't also like the fact they can't use the royal brand, but in fact they'll do very well without using it. I mean, the point is, it's got pretty petty. There is a lot of unhappiness. There's no doubt it's all public. The point is, they should concentrate on getting the charitable activism going and also earning those megabucks, which I'm sure they can.
Probably their podcast and their Oprah guests lots.
Serena Williams, Jay Lowe, Cooney's, what more do you want? And anyway, they could do, whether it's audio books or lectures.
Give them an appearance on the Midweek Drive, you know, so we can accommodate from that point of view. It's worthwhile.
You asked?
No, we don't ask these days. People ask us, Richard. I mean, you know, sorry.
All right, you are.
Good Lord. I mean, the standards, please.
Yeah. There it is.
A long discussion with respect to Eva MacDonald last night after the show when we were talking about these sort of things. By the way, happy birthday, Robin Pierce, by the way. It's his birthday today.
Oh, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Exactly. Just in case he's listening, he won't be, but, you know, he might listen to the podcast. In the studio, Catherine Dove, who quite a royal family watcher, I think, Catherine? So does the Queen. So does, obviously, on the other hand, Emily is a righteous royalist, basically.
Keep up to date with the royal family, but I'm not everyday reading about it.
And David Frank.
But you are supportive overall. You'd rather not have a republic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
so,
I do like the royal. I do like having
so
the royal family.
So no chance
yes.
of President Johnson, basically.
No.
And, never mind. And of course, David Fox. Presumably, it's never been the same since James the VI actually decided to leave Scotland and actually become James the I of England. Really, from your point of view.
Well, yeah, interesting period that. Of course, me and Catherine were chatting about history before we started today, but yeah, I think they do a lot of good, and I think that I'd rather have a monarchy than not have a monarchy. It's a good institution.
I mean, yes. I believe that Scotland might actually reinstitute their own routine with Queen Nicola in the near future.
Well, there's that possibility, of course, but I doubt it.
Let us move on to Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which sounds a bit like one of David Fox's magic tricks, but probably isn't, because it's a movie, Richard, which you're going to talk to us about.
It's an absolutely fascinating movie. It's been much praised. It's directed by Celine Sciamma, and it's set in 18th century France as the France moves towards the revolution. We meet Heloise, who's been in a convent. She's going to be married, which is not something that appeals to her. And this is set on an isolated island in Brittany, where Marianne, played by Noémie Merlant, Heloise, incidentally, is played by Adèle Haenel, both are absolutely superb, is hired as a companion by Heloise's mother, but in point of fact, secretly, she is commissioned to paint her. even though Heloise does not want to be painted. She doesn't want to marry, but of course, in those days, women's rights were, putting it mildly, very few, and this is fascinating to see. It's a study of the portrait painter, of course, was not regarded highly class-wise in society, but this intimacy develops between them, and it's a fascinating, nuanced study, both as a period film, beautifully photographed, and also what is so fascinating is as the relationship between them develops, they help, for example, their maid have an abortion. There's no doubt also that Eloise is destined for a life which she doesn't choose. What happens? How does it develop? A lovely, nuanced film which has made a hit, been a hit worldwide, quite literally, with critics, which is an absolute delight. Also, I do hope people will see this film, because the two central performances are absolutely superb. And what is fascinating is Eloise's response when she discovers that her companion is, in fact, an artist who's pretending to simply keep her company and is in reality painting this portrait. What happens to the portrait? It begins with flashbacks, and it ends with, I have to say, I was moist-eyed at it. I really thought that this was a sensitive film. It's one in which was I saw first in the London Film Festival, and as a tale of sapphic love, which, of course, was forbidden in the 18th century, as a period movie, and also a study of the various gradations of class. This is a little gem.
Interesting to see the Observer described as a ravishing masterpiece, which I think, fair enough. Meanwhile, a Variety actually says the world looks different when seen through a woman's eyes. That's got to be fairly self-evident, hasn't it? I mean, surely, you know, I mean, what were they thinking when the world looks different when seen through a woman's eyes? Well, yeah, it looks different when you actually look it through anybody's eyes from that point of view.
Well, it looks different also when you see a film that's crafted in this way, and I have to say I thought Adele Hanel and Naomi Melo were absolutely superb. It's a subtle film, and you get drawn into it. You get to know its characters, and also you start also getting a feel for the place and a feel for the period. And there's some very, very telling and touching scenes climactically.
Okay, let's put it to the team then. Emily Boston, will you be investigating Portrait of a Lady on Fire?
I think it sounds like a film which is right down my street, so I definitely will be giving this one a watch, yes.
Oh, good.
David Fox?
I wouldn't say no. It's not my type of movie, not my type of genre, but
French,
if I had to...
French and Scottish, there's a bond there.
Well,
think
of
Mary
Queen. Alliance.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, you realise we're building this up because England will be left alone in the not-too-distant future, so I'm fully expecting Scotland and France.
Again. Well, yes. It's
quite a strategic point here.
Looks very interesting, and as always, a very interesting analysis from Richard. Always enjoy listening to what he has to say about the movies.
That's why he has a regular feature. That's why he's not just at CNN. He's under demand. That's the important thing. Catherine?
I'm quite interested in seeing it. I think I've just seen the trailer so far, but it looks beautifully shot, and like the use of colours and stuff, it's gorgeous.
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating. And as I say, it moves at what is absolutely correct pace for the development of the relationship between them, and also for studying the characters and getting involved in the story, and also the fact that obviously there are aspects of this, given the way women were treated in that period, where it may well not end happily, but there are surprises, and no spoilers from me, but indeed it will rivet you.
Meanwhile, according to Carl Kat Halstead, the latest collaboration between Steve Coogan and director Michael Winterbottom is starting to look a little tired. From Empire magazine, like Maximus, the hero who inspires the theme of its pivotal party, greed will keep you entertained, but patchiness and occasional preachiness mar a clearly heartfelt message movie. What, on the other hand, is your take on greed, Richard Fitzwilliams?
Well, I mean, I saw the trailer for this, and I knew perfectly well it wasn't...
You saw the trailer?
Well, I had no choice. Sometimes you're tired, you get to a film, and you wander in a few minutes before when you need to sit down, and the trailer made abundantly clear that Steve Coogan was going to have a glorious time hamming it up as Sir Richard, in brackets, Greedy MacCready, who is clearly, obviously, though the film has to do a slight distance for legal reasons, it's only very slight, it's obviously based on Sir Philip Green and his experiences in his retail empire, how he built it up. I mean, we see the way MacCready rises from early days as a ruthless troublemaker and also somebody who's prepared to do anything to make money. That's all he cares about. I mean, this is, as I say, is anything but subtle. But, of course, as you will recall, Sir Philip Green with his Sir Philip Green, he of Arcadia, but he also of BHS, and the story there is well known for those who want to look back upon it. But BHS's collapse and the fact that the pension fund was completely underfunded, the vast amounts of money that were in owing, and the fact that Sir Philip was finally, that is probably why he's still Sir, able or forced to fork out some 360 or so million pounds to keep it going. All of this, and Sir Philip's extraordinary appearance before the Commons Committee, which was looking at the way he was running, if that is the way, the so-called empire. All of this is wonderful material for Michael Winterbottom because, obviously, this hideously twisted creature who pays the absolute bare minimum and less than it for workers in Asia to create the textile empire. It's also full of jibes at the fashion industry, which aren't subtle, I have to say, that they're in fact paying those who make the clothes, and it may be true, indeed it may, very, very tiny amounts. The minimum, whilst we see the gorgeous creatures disport themselves on the catwalk, think of those in the sweatshops. But Sir Greedy, this is the problem. After humiliation in front of the committee, he wants on the island of Mykonos to have a gladiator themed party to celebrate his 60th, and we'd have Stephen Fry as a host, would you believe? And, you know, deprived of the BAFTAs. Look at him, there he is. The problem with it is, on a certain level, it's quite entertaining. But if you've got building a Colosseum, if you have a lion around, dare I mention it, and if you're having this gladiator-themed party with everyone in togas, or even if your top guests are dropping out, there are not going to be perhaps that number of surprises awaiting. I have to say I was entertained on a superficial level by it. The point it is making is perfectly obvious, and no one can possibly miss it. But the facts are that Green's hanging on to his knighthood was unbelievable. We see here Coogan thoroughly enjoying hamming it up. The rest of the cast do what they're, so to speak, supposed to. There are a collection of sharks around MacCready. Ex-wife Shirley, played by Isla Fisher. There's Nick, played by David Mitchell, who isn't too bad as someone who's supposed to write up the life of this monster. But how do monsters end their lives? Could the party be a disaster? I mean, I'm sure you've worked it out.
It's the uncertainty that makes life so interesting. Remember, Richard, the devil is in the retail.
And could you have seen a poster and seen that? I think you did.
Yeah, well, you know, these importance, you've got to actually use these inspirational moments to actually craft the whole thing. If they need to have parties organised, they should actually get Liz Brewer on the case, really, as a party planning etiquette expert.
Very, very amused. I'm not sure that Liz would have accepted Sir Greedy's invitation. The problem is, of course, you see, also, when you've got a tame lion wandering around, and the other thing is, you know, what happens if the Colosseum's not being built properly?
Strange. I've always felt we should actually have a tame lion in the Siren Studios, given that Lefchuk translates from the original Polish as little lion. I think it would be very apt. But anyway, that's a little lie. Catherine, Greed, is it something which you'll think, yeah, I need my fulfilment of Steve Coogan?
I don't know. I think I quite like Steve Coogan and kind of how he plays larger-than-life characters like Alan Partridge and kind of all these kind of comedic characters. So I'm quite interested to see how he takes on a slightly more serious role, but I'm not surprised that it sounds very kind of preachy at parts.
Mm. Well, I mean, it certainly at the end you have statistics which do get you thinking. I have to say the problem is that they do veer away from just the message about how the sweatshops underpay to the gap between rich and poor and all of this. I mean, it's obvious where Winterbottom's heart is, because obviously Sir Greedy McCready has no heart. Of course he has.
Kind of the clue is in the name, isn't it, really? Greedy McCready? It's a slight...
No, I didn't pick that up.
Did you? Yeah. So, David...
What kind of Shades of Wall Street there? What are my favourite movies?
Not as subtle as Wall Street.
Well, the Gordon Gekko's Greed is good. Yeah. The parallel's obvious. The thing was Michael Douglas had, I think, a better script. And also, at that particular time, the Wall Street and then its successor with Gordon Gekko, he did become an internationally known monster. I thought that Douglas humanised him rather well. There's not much humanising about McCready, but I don't think, quite honestly, there's very much about Philip Green. So I would say that if the film highlights the horrible conditions in the sweatshops, it is doing some good. I mean, Winterbottom obviously has been following Green with the greatest of care, and obviously, Green is not going to see. He put out a statement saying he wasn't going to see Green, which I thought was hilarious, but the facts are that his reputation already is...
preceded him.
Sunk to terrifying levels.
Hey.
But if you
what about...
But there is one scene, I do have to say, there is one scene in this film that is absolutely unforgettable, and that's what happens to Sir Greedy. So,
Richard, here's one for you. You can put this out in the social media. Philip Green as advisor to Meghan and Harry. Yeah? Yeah, I mean, that's got to be a winner for the tabloids, surely. You know, that's got to be a good... just put it out there. It's gone very quiet.
That's good, Alex. I think you should expand your horizons into the PR world. Sons, Shines, Sachs, PR in America are waiting for tidbits of that sort. You know, they want ideas.
Well, you know, one doesn't actually be programme leader for communications and public relations at the University of Lincoln without actually being prepared to think outside the box. And I just put that out there as a possibility. Emily, Greed.
I mean, from watching the trailer, it does seem interesting. And if I was asked to go and watch it, again, I wouldn't say no, like David with the previous film, but... I'd say I'm definitely more enthusiastic about Portrait of a Lady on Fire than I would be about seeing Greed.
Even remotely comparable. Talk about movies, two contrasting films, which is why I thought we'd slip Greed in.
Sometimes you need a bit of roughage, that's the important thing.
Roughage is certainly what you could describe McCready's career as, because he will always strike the most vicious bargain. The problem... Here's one of the difficulties, that Coogan probably doesn't humanise this character. I mean, for any villain, you need a little... A touch of humanity somewhere about them.
We have been called by Jenny McLachlan, an award-winning author who's set to talk about The Land of Raw, Flirty Dancing, and Why Children Should Read. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Well, I certainly have, yes.
We will speak next week.
We shall. We most certainly shall. I shall be back from Madrid and be reporting on that too. To you, you put up a fight. You're the last to leave. Now turn up the light. You dance to the devil and the feathery wife. Now the Ordnance Survey is mapping out your life. Look at the small print, it's what we agree. Sign your name before we teach you how to read. This is the land of do what you're told. The land of the free, if you don't leave the fold. Smile a little wider as you're waiting to be sold. This is the land. You told.
celebrity, let me in here. One last jump from the end of the pier. We breached the wall, but I was too tired to run. My get up and go got up and now it's gone. Look at the small print, it's what we agreed. Sign your name before we teach you how to read. This is the land of do what you're told.
So it's just as well we got two English undergraduates in the studio with us, because new research has revealed that children's independent reading is in crisis and the frequency of children reading for pleasure has declined over the last decade. In 2012, more than half of children aged 5 to 10 read books. However, by 2019, that's dropped to 41%. Now, to actually address this, two fabulous folk we've got. First of all, ace author, award-winning author, and indeed creator of The Land of Raw and Flirty Dancing, the fabulous Jenny McLachlan. How are you, Jenny?
Oh, very well. After hearing that, that was lovely.
Important. And Consumer Insight Director at Egmont, the wonderful Alison David. How are you, Alison?
Hello. I'm fine, thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Alison, talk us through this. I mean, I think it's a tragedy, but why is it that independent reading by children has been declining so much? I mean, that's 55% to 41%, 14% decline in just literally under 8 years.
Yes, it's quick, isn't it? There are three main reasons, really. I think the main one is that they're not read to frequently enough or long enough, either at home or at school. We've also got a lot of time being spent on digital entertainment, which is obviously taking away time for reading as well as other things. And also there's something about the way children experience reading through school. It seems to make it seem like a subject to learn and not so much about fun and a great choice of entertainment. So there's three main reasons there, I'd say.
Jenny, we mentioned obviously The Land of Raw, Flirty Dancing, amongst many, many others that you've actually produced about, but you're quite passionate about children's independent reading. So this story time scenario, just talk us through this whole sort of basis of how that can actually help to get to that line, as Alison was saying there, about being read to and developing the love of reading from that.
I've been passionate about this really all my life. It's probably one of the reasons I became an English teacher and then one of the reasons I became an author as well. And I think that parents perhaps don't know the absolutely incredible impact that they can have on their child's future if they read to them at night. I think maybe it's seen as a nice thing to do if you've got the time, but it has an incredible impact on their achievement at school, on their mental health, on their ability to have empathy, on their imagination. I mean, children who have a reading habit, their own reading habit, who enjoy reading, basically do better at school, and that's a fact. So really, I imagine a lot of parents probably think that their children are being read to in school for fun, but in fact, it's only 20% of children will experience that every day in school, and that's fallen. I mean, I remember it was always a part of my day in school at the end of the day was story time, but schools, teachers are so overburdened, the curriculum is so overburdened that sometimes they just don't have the time to do that, even if they want to do it. So that's something that we're really keen to change, and people can, there's actually a petition that we're keen for people to sign to encourage this to become part of the school day that can be accessed at egmont.co.uk. And I'd love anybody who loves reading and loves the idea of children reading to sign it.
As I mentioned, we've got two fabulous final year English undergraduates from the University of Lincoln in the studio with us, and indeed a former English teacher now turned magician, and a very successful magician, David Fox. But let's turn to Catherine first. I mean, are you shocked by this? Were you read to as a child? What are your thoughts on this one?
I am quite shocked. I think, I don't know, I wasn't read to that I remember as a child too much, but I always had a lot of kind of access to like Roald Dahl and
Jenny McLachlan.
I think you're a bit before my time as a child.
Okay.
But yeah, and so that sort of encouraged me and kind of grew my passion, and sort of allowing me to explore it sort of independently. I mean, do you worry that kind of having it as a enforced thing of story time in school lead it to be something that the students like feel can just be read to them, or do you think it will be kind of encourage them to search out their own kind of literature?
Can I answer that one?
You may.
Go.
Wonderful. Well, I just wanted to share with you an experiment or a project that we tried with the school in Stoke-on-Trent. where we arrange for the children in Key Stage 2, that's 7 to 11-year-olds, to be read to every day by the teachers. And it was just for fun, so there was no hint of any learning or teaching around it. And the result of that was absolutely astonishing. The children were much more motivated to read themselves for fun, to choose to read, and also their attainment skyrocketed. So actually their reading comprehension improved at twice the expected rate just by having story time for fun. So I think that's what's important about it, is it mustn't seem like a lesson at all. It's just the sheer pleasure and the escape of it, and it's amazing for both well-being and attainment.
Well, a definite thumbs up from Alison from that point of view. David, you're listening to this probably with interest because you've taught, obviously, English in France. You've taught English from that point of view up to secondary schools as opposed to anything else. But what about this sort of educational background we've been talking about?
Well, yes, as you're saying there, I very much see reading as something for personal development as opposed to hit a grade or a target. And I think there's a lot of pressure on children at school to hit a particular grade or a target, or to have some sort of rationale behind doing something.
Got to get the school books should up be the enjoyed. Tables, yeah, up yeah. The league tables.
Well, books should be enjoyed. There should be a kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Like a period where, as you say, it should be something enjoyable, because we do develop there personally and in many different ways from a good relationship with books.
And Emily, were you read to as a child?
Yeah, I actually think it's really sad, because I think from a young age I've always loved reading. I've always been quite passionate about it. Obviously, I'm studying at university at the moment. Well, not reading, but English. And because studying reading would not be a degree. But yeah, I think I was passionate about it. And when I was younger, my mum and dad would read to me quite a lot. So I think it's sad, the statistics. But I'm intrigued to know, do you think that digital entertainment and children having phones at a much younger age is something that is impacting this quite a lot? Do you think that's one of the main factors?
Well, I think as a parent, definitely. I mean, I think there's evidence, clear evidence for this as well, but, you know, if I gave my children the choice between picking up an iPad or sitting down and reading a book, although they do love reading, they would probably choose the iPad. It's immediate, it's exciting, but I suppose the answer to that is they don't have the choice. That's a difficult thing to do. I know it's a really difficult thing to do. So I think that what I've done is try to keep that time upstairs, that bedtime. It's very much to do with the real papery books in their hands reading. I don't mind what they read at all, but they read before they fall asleep, and they read with me.
A little bit of Crime and Punishment, Dostoevsky, perhaps, you know, is quite useful. Brothers Karamazov, all great. Start on the easy works and move from there. Remind us once again of the petition that people can actually sign to make daily story time a part of the statutory curriculum, because there's a really significant point that we want to actually at least make that comment loud and clear from this point of view. I mean, where should people actually go to, Alison?
Yes, it's on change.org. If you just search for that and then statutory story time, you'll find it. And also there's information about the campaign on the Egmont website, egmont.co.uk.
Fantastic. Jenny McLachlan, ACE author, and indeed Alison David, ACE Consumer Insight Director. Many thanks indeed. Hopefully we'll speak again in the very near future and continue with news of your fabulous campaign to actually ensure that independent reading, the decline will be reversed. We'll actually get people using the power of the imagination much more effectively.
Thank you very much.
Round of applause for Jenny and Alison, please. Yay! It's a little after 70 minutes to 9 o'clock here on Siren Radio, and Ian Lennox has joined us from Newcastle on the tune. How are you, Ian?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. I actually lowered the other microphones of the three guests because David was in the midst of doing full magical productions there. And Emily, what did you think of David Fox's magic?
I'm amazed. I really want to know how you managed to do that because I'm really amazed.
He could tell you, but then he'd have to actually execute you. It's unfortunate, and we don't want to lose you, Emily. You know, you've done well, so, you know, it's... I know we haven't...
How did you do a ventriloquist act? It went very well done on the radio.
I know this, Ian. And your tap dancing as well. It's just so super sensational, honestly. And Catherine, what did you make of your first experience of the Fox Magic world?
Yeah, I am still slightly in shock.
See, Catherine Dove, making her debut on the morning edition. She's a regular midweek drive. And, of course, Emily Bolton, a Boston, I should say. Emily Bolton, of course, was an actress in Moonraker. Easily confused, you know. And one was a Bond girl, one as an X6 lad. You know, it's one of the two things that's actually there. Emily Boston, obviously keen to find out from yourself, Ian, about life, the universe, and what sort of things you've been getting up to.
Well, I've been fending off this virus thing I've had for about 3 months.
Coronavirus?
No.
Please.
Me yet.
Let's make sure that...
It might have got the bottom of my stairs, but I live in a three-storey house, Alex.
I think we should immediately set up a zone of containment around the entire area of Tyneside. And, of course, I forgot that. It's already there. It's the biker wall. Oh, never mind. Okay, well, we wish you well, Ian. That's the important thing.
Well, we do.
Look, you're a Newcastle United supporter. You need as much help as you can get these days. So it's
I've been actually revising the book I've been writing.
Have you?
On draft 3 now, so we've been working on that quite hard.
Very good. And have you got a title as yet?
Nope.
So actually... much like yourself, Catherine, in your dissertation, you see, it's being written, but no title.
Yeah.
David Fox, as I say, is with us. I think you spoke to Ian before. What would you like to chat to him about, David? I mean, you've got a few moments.
Lovely to hear from you again, Ian. And just sorry to hear you've been under the weather with this virus that's been going around. In terms of the book, I mean, do you have a schedule? Do you write every morning? Is it a case of you dip in and out?
Once I start doing it, I make myself write a minimum of 500 words every day.
Yeah.
And if I don't do that, I feel guilty. Mm-hmm. It's like a self-discipline. But I was a journalist for years and years before all that, so I've been able to make myself write. And I could write in the middle of a traffic island, really. I can just sit and write, you know, and cut myself off.
Yes. It's like a muscle.
I used to do little talks to people on writing books, and I was amazed how... each writer had his own way of doing things, you know. Mm-hmm. Hemingway used to write standing up occasionally. George Simenon used to go into a room for 9 days on his own and come out with a book.
See, that's all you need, effectively, you know, Catherine. Yeah. 9 days in a room alone. Emily, try that for your dissertation.
Lock ourselves away.
Remember to take a sandwich in with you if you do.
Different standards.
It was also, you know, amazing the different ways people used to write. Some people used to go abroad because they thought living surrounded by a foreign language made you think harder, you know. You had to obviously work at communication, so your brain was working harder and things like that. And other people used to go to this particular hotel, particular room. It was quite fascinating, really. There's one guy, I think, wrote in shorthand. There's a lady, I can't remember her name now, the Edwardian... She had a tree house. She used to go there and write.
Yeah, of course, Arthur Miller. He would actually act out the plays that he created. He would be very histrionic in his room, acting it all out. And yes,
oh, that's interesting. Yes. I did the last interview with Catherine Cookson. I think it was the last one. And she talked about writing. And first of all, she could type. She used to write the thing in longhand. Then she used to type, I think. And then when her hands became, I think, more arthritic, I'm not sure, she used to dictate to a secretary, but then she finally dictated into a tape machine. And she used to go in a room on her own. If you stood outside, you could hear her voice changed with all the different characters. She was actually living the thing as she went through it. It was in her mind. And I think a lot of people do that.
Who would have thought that actually several years after the passing of Catherine Cookson that one of her plays would be adapted for the new Theatre Royal Lincoln at the Cinderpath as a musical? I know.
Oh, was it? Oh, yeah, right, okay. Yeah,
it's coming up shortly.
Great. I got on very well with her, actually. She was, I thought she'd be a rather flossy lady, but she wasn't. She
no, that's Barbara Cartland. Like Barbara Cartland was a very flossy lady. Catherine Cookson, much more sort of grounded. Easily confused, obviously. You know, you got your, you got your sort of...
she hated being thought as a woman's writer as well. Absolutely hated this.
She's a writer, first and foremost. End of.
Yes.
Gender should not make any difference. Did you realise, Ian, that most young people cannot name a single female entrepreneur? 81% of 11 to 18-year-olds cannot name a single female entrepreneur. Yeah, something we'll be talking about with business owner and British television presenter Sarah Kahn in the next part of the programme, together with the head of Breakthrough at Santander, Louise Robinson. Sarah's also apparently a Loose Women panellist. I wasn't aware of that. Mind you, I haven't watched Loose Women for many a year, really. So it's not really my sort of cup of tea. But I don't know. On the other hand, it could be quite interesting sort of stuff. Still, I'm still coming to terms with the stress of Tipping Point, really. That's a very stressful programme. You know, will they tip? Will they not? Will they not tip? Very, very difficult, you know. It is heavily, you know. I didn't realise sort of think how much. And then when Ben Shepherd asked those sort of questions, you know, where's it going to go? Will it go 3-2? Oh, well. Catherine, anything you want to put to Ian about life, the universe, or what it's like as a Stevenage soul actually speaking to a lad from the Tyne?
What?
A lad from the Tyne.
Good Lord. I
suppose I'd better take this opportunity to ask how best can I write my dissertation? Deadline's looming. How do I really make the most of this time and bring out some good words?
Have you done your preparatory work? Have you done research and stuff?
Yeah, that's all under my belt now. I just need to write it.
I can only tell the way I would do it if I was doing the thing. But it might be different for you. I'd write if it's a very long one. And it's quite complicated. I would write some bullet points down, the most important things you think of in your dissertation, the one things that you want to get across, and try and get them at the top of it. I'd do it that way.
Thank you very much.
Emily. No pressure, but basically, if Catherine doesn't now get a first in, we'll be out to get you. Okay, I mean, that's the bottom
I'll
line.
I'll hold you entirely responsible.
This is going to be critical. Emily.
My question is much more generic. I'm just intrigued to know if you've given up anything for Len.
Nice.
Me?
Following on from last night's show, actually.
No, I never do, no.
He's a heathen. Honestly.
Don't make promises you can't keep. I'm not a sort of giver-upper. I just, actually, that's not true. If I think I'm getting too fat, I'll start trying to lose weight. And I've been looking at my life, because I can lose weight quite quickly normally. Much the envy of my sisters.
High metabolic rates, Ian. High metabolic rates. That's what it's all down to. High metabolic rates. He says for the third time.
The trouble is, if you get ill, you think.
Yeah, well, then you're dead. No immune whatsoever. It's a case of offsetting one thing with the other. David.
Well, in terms of the new novel, Ian, do you have a deadline or a...
No. It's the most bizarre thing, really. I've written 6 books now, I think. This is the 7th. And I started it because, as Alex said, I had 2 cats who were killed in road accidents within 2 days of each other. And I got really depressed by it. So I thought, well, really, the thing I've got to do is to start getting active over things. So... on a whim, I went off to Spain for a month, actually this time last year, and I started to write a novel there. And I hadn't done all the preparatory work that I should do, but fortunately, the book itself is set in a newspaper office in the 60s, so I knew empirically all the sort of knowledge I had to have. So yes. I was very lucky. I just knew through living through it at the time. You know, how much the bus fare costs, the way the office worked in the 60s. And usually it was in a prime then, so they're quite quite confident. So basically, I managed to avoid what could have been a major fault. I can imagine if I'd stored other subjects, I would have got about 10,000 words in. and just had to stop and start doing research. Because unless you know the environment in which you're writing about,
it
just can't work.
It's semi-biographical.
It's just knowing the restrictions that people had in those days, no mobile phones, or, you know, little things like that, bus fares, how much they cost and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Because
yes.
once you go into that sort of detail, and if you get that wrong, you've had it. It becomes ludicrous.
Just call it fantasy, and that's all. Just call it fantasy. Don't try and do reality. Just call it fantasy. You can break the rules then. I can actually hear, at this very moment in time, a little... I can hear Ollie and Oboe channeling their kind thoughts. I mean, I know, obviously, we haven't spoke about this for quite some time, Ian, but in a strange black comedy way, I mean, obviously, to lose one little cat, you know, Ollie headed off, etc., and to be killed in a road accident, but then for the same thing to happen 2 or 3 days later, it was
terrible, yeah. For me, it was, because I live on my own now, and, you know, I got very close to them, really. Mm-hmm.
Well, they're still there, looking down from feline heaven, and probably creating all sorts of things. And you've always got the Midweek Drive Morning Edition, Ian, you know?
Funny enough, when those are on Facebook, as you know, and they send you these Facebook memories, and a couple of days ago, they sent me a picture of the two of them from 4 years ago. So anyway.
That Mark Zuckerberg knows how to twist the knife, doesn't he, really?
Just, all this, that's what Nicholson and I did, too.
Well, we'll go there. That's, a long-suffering Magpies fan, yes.
That's,
yeah.
Anyway, so it goes. Who would you like to ask you those last two questions, Ian? Would it be Emily, or would it be David, or would it actually be Catherine?
I have Catherine.
Have you had a reasonably enjoyable telephonic link with us this morning?
Yes, I have, thank you, yes.
Glad to hear it. And will you be joining us again?
I hope so. I'll be 10,000 words on, but I'll still talk to you.
So lock yourself away, that's the important thing.
Okay, mate.
Nine days, marvellous things will happen. Ian, take care, speak soon.
Okay, then.
And coming up after the news, we'll be talking about sight and the most important sense of all. Already in the studio and set and ready to go, we've got the fabulous Dr. Claire O'Donnell and Alex Short. Good morning, Claire. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning.
Excellent. We've got the news from the Sky News Centre coming up now, and then we'll be with you in full force.
FM. Online. Mobile. This is Siren Radio. Lincoln.
Excellent. And the weather today, highs of 7 degrees centigrade, lows of minus 1 degree centigrade, a day of fresh breezes and sleet showers. So not good visibility in some ways. Now, Optigra High Healthcare is urging Brits to get a deeper understanding of the issues that can exist for people of all ages. Recent research has suggested that over half of British women are completely unaware that each item had a best before date when it opened. Over half wear mascara over 4 months old, despite their expiry date being 4 months. And a third even have makeup over 5 years old. Now to talk us through this, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous folk. First of all, qualified optometrist, the wonderful Dr. Claire O'Donnell. How are you, Claire?
I'm great, thank you.
Excellent. And of course, from Optigra's research division, consultant eye surgeon, I should say, Alex Short.
Hello there.
Excellent. Claire, of course, heading up Optigra's research division. And now in the studio, we've got three fine folk here. I think, David, you wear glasses?
Yeah, I don't you actually don't. Know. I'm so lucky enough.
Visually, you're the only one in the studio then that isn't actually wearing glasses at present.
I've never noticed that. That's true.
It's all the reading we're doing. Emily, any thoughts on those findings that we actually heard in terms of the research about a lack of awareness in terms of our eyes?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting insight, and a lot of people I know, it sounds awful to say, but there is a lot of people who put off eye tests or say that they've missed their eye test and they'll have to book another one in. And I do think sometimes it is put off when it is really important to make sure you are checking up on your eyes. So it is an interesting insight.
So, Claire, why is this? Why is this tendency to actually say, I mean, is it just a case of we're frightened of opticians? It's such a bit like we've become the 21st century version of the dentist, etc. All these technological things, we think, oh, what's going to happen?
I think it's maybe just a case of a lot of eye conditions don't really have any symptoms, so we all lead busy lives and we tend to put things off until, you know, we're really forced in many cases to go in. Again, you know, research has shown time and time again that although people value their eyesight more than any of our other senses, yeah, a great proportion of us just don't have our eyes examined and we don't know how to look after our eyes properly.
Mm. And the line about cataracts becoming more common in younger people, is that because of more eye makeup? Is that something? I mean, because again, traditionally that was something which was usually regarded as something for the over 70s, shall we say? But now we're getting in the 50s, 60s, etc. A third of British adults say they know somebody who has actually had treatment for cataracts.
Well, I think it's not that cataract itself has become more common. It's that we now intervene and treat cataracts at a much earlier stage. There's this great old wives' tale that we hear time and time again that you need to wait for a cataract to be ripe. And that came from the 1970s when we had an old style of cataract operation that you had to wait for the cataract to be sufficiently hard in order to treat it. But then we now have a new keyhole technique which involves a tiny, tiny micro incision in the eye. And in general, it's much easier to remove the cataract at an earlier stage through our new technique.
Mm. Which is obviously great news, given that cataracts accounted in 2010 for around 20 million cases of blindness worldwide, and a significant sort of improvement from that point of view. Catherine, thoughts from yourself as a spectacle wearer?
Yeah, and actually I used to work in opticians as well when I was doing my A-levels, and it's just the kind of... You do see a lot of people who are a good few years kind of out of date for their eye check. And I think I myself am probably a few years out of date now just because I haven't got round to it. And so, yeah, how do you think it would kind of be possible to keep the idea of getting regular eye checks within, like, the public consciousness? Do you think that there should be more raising awareness of eye checks? Like, how would you go about that?
I think you're absolutely right, and we at Optigra are keen to do our part in just raising awareness, which is kind of why we commissioned this research in the first place, Catherine. But again, people just need to be mindful of some of the red flag signs. So diarise your appointments. Opticians are usually pretty good at sending out reminders,
but be mindful of changes in your vision at all. Looking out for kids that are kind of moving closer to TV or appear to be struggling, that could be a sign of short-sightedness. Certainly when we get older, changes in our vision, such as distortion in our straight-ahead vision, these are things that kind of need to be looked at quickly. So I guess a key message is any changes to your vision at all, do not put off, go and make that appointment today.
And something which, again, we talked about in the early opening part of this, which I thought was quite intriguing, is what are the risks around using out-of-date makeup? I mean, I don't use it myself, personally, but, you know, I'm just sort of thinking in terms of that, because I don't know. I mean, Emily, did you sort of think about your makeup's out-of-date? That's it. It could be a disaster.
I actually know a few of my friends who have... I never really knew that makeup actually had out-of-date. I know it sounds silly, but it had a use-by date. But I know a few of my friends who've used mascara that might have gone out of date, and they're like, oh, I've not got anything else, so I'll just pop it on before I put my lashes on or whatever. And I do know people have used it before, so not me personally myself, but I know a few people who are culprit to that, yeah.
Claire, what's the risk?
Yeah, I guess the risk really is infection. So keeping makeup for a long time, we kind of know that it can cause bugs to breed. And if you're unlucky and you happen to scratch your eye with a mascara on that's covered in bugs, that could lead to quite a serious corneal eye infection. So that's why now I think manufacturers do put these, you know, best to use after a certain day. And it's a little sign on the back, you know, looks like a pot being opened with a 6 month or 4 month, whatever that recommended period is. Because our research shows that, again, many people are just completely unaware that there's an issue with keeping makeup for years and years and years. So check that makeup bag today, ladies.
Emma Street, welcome to the programme. Good to see that you're sort of on board for this health system. Now, again, another sort of person who I believe is a spectacle wearer, has had glasses and various other bits. Or do you use contacts? What's your sort of eye care system?
I use glasses for reading when I remember. Okay. I haven't worn them for a very long time now.
Right, there we are. Now, there's another little question, Alex. Emma uses glasses for reading when she remembers.
I'm really bad.
There is another myth we hear is that if you start to wear glasses, you become increasingly dependent on them. And I'm afraid that is a myth. What you're experiencing, Anna, is a change in your vision. And it's most likely due to a process called presbyopia. And that tells us, this loss of your reading vision, tells us that your natural lens in your eye has absorbed lots of UV light from the atmosphere over a couple of years. And it's beginning to stiffen and harden, so that when you try and focus your eye close up, your lens is stiff and it won't do that close-up focus anymore. And what you're doing by wearing reading glasses is simply giving some magnification so that you can see smaller things more easily.
So there we are, Emma. Let's work through that. Now, there's so much more we can speak about. We haven't got time, unfortunately. So where, Claire, can people actually go to find out further information about Optigra Eye Healthcare and indeed this research as well?
Yeah, we've got a great website. So I would encourage people to check out our Optigra.com website, where you'll find details about, you know, treatments, eye conditions, all the information about our open evenings and things that we encourage people to come and find out more.
Excellent. Alex Short, Optigra consultant eye surgeon, and Dr. Claire O'Donnell, qualified optometrist, and indeed the head of Optigra's research division. Many thanks indeed, and hopefully we'll speak again in the near future.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Somebody.
Billy Idol, Eyes Without a Face. So let's do a quick survey now as we prepare the way for our next feature, which will be David Cunningham, Programme Director of Britain's Beer Alliance. Do we have any beer drinkers in the studio? I mean, let's turn to Emma. Are you a beer drinker?
I'm not a beer drinker.
No. Emily?
No, beer makes me sick.
Yeah, okay. That's fine. And Catherine?
I'm afraid not, no. No.
David?
Like beer, but I prefer Guinness. Guinness isn't more of a stout.
Not a beer drinker, but today, apparently, the UK will have paid as much in beer duty as Germany will pay all year.
Wow.
Yeah, beer duty in the first 2 months of 2020 is as high in Britain as Germany does an entire year. Well, you know, we'll find out about this with David Cunningham, Programme Director of Britain's Beer Alliance. I think we know what line he's going to take. Still to come, of course, we're going to be talking about that female entrepreneur lack of knowledge with Sarah Khan, and Angela Rippon will be joining us back on the show because, well, it's good to have her back. Okay, that's pretty much it for the moment. Up next, as we said, beer. So I think it's the case of what? ZZ Top and beer drinkers and Hellraisers. What do you think, Emily? You think that would be a cliched line to actually do with ZZ Top? You know, bearded drinking beer people?
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm quite intrigued to find out.
ZZ Top, beer drinkers and hell raisers. Well, maybe it's a case of Germany, UK and all sorts of things. Quite rightly, with those kind of figures, i.e. by today, we've paid as much in beer duty as Germany will pay all year in 2020. It's maybe no surprise that 13,000 pubs have closed in the past 20 years. So, to talk us through this, we're delighted to welcome from Britain's Beer Alliance, the wonderful David Cunningham. How are you, David?
Morning, I'm very well, thank you.
Now, it's fair to say, in the studio, there's really only one sort of semi-regular beer drinker, and that person said they prefer another brand called By G. It's an Irish brand, you may have heard of it. But this seems a little bit unfair in terms of numbers that we've actually got. I mean, the UK beer duty 11 times higher than Spain. It brings in £3.4 billion a year to the tax officers, etc. Well, I suppose Megan's got a minute. We'll go there. But, I mean, how long has this been going on for? I mean, presumably for most of the 21st century.
Yep, our beer duty has been historically high and historically much higher than Europe. We have one of the highest rates across the whole of Europe, and as you said, 11 times higher in the UK than Spain and Germany. So your fact about today being the day when we pay the same amount of beer duty as Germany will do in the whole of the year, in addition to that extraordinary fact, it's also the fact that Germans drink twice as much beer as we do in the UK. So it just shows you how relatively unfair it is. And on every single pint in the UK, we pay 54 pence in every pint in beer duty alone versus Spain and other countries like Germany, where it's less than 5 pence. And this really does have a detrimental impact on pubs, hence the fact that over the last 20 years, we've lost 13,000 pubs across the whole of the nation. These are vital community spaces that need protecting.
And looking at some of the numbers that are involved here, the pub and brewing sector account for 900,000 jobs. It's worth £23 billion to the economy, based, as we said, £13 billion in taxes. We're fortnight away from the first budget, of course, of this government. Are you optimistic, or is it a case of, no, I'm sorry, but I'm sure that the government have already decided exactly what they're going to do, and the fact that we've had a change of chancellor, that's going to be irrelevant?
Well, we're asking Rishi Sunak and the government to recognise pubs as being not just important economically, but also crucially socially and culturally. And instead of the planned increase that they've written into the Red Book for March the 11th, we're asking them to actually a modest cut, 2% cut, a penny off a pint of beer, but that will have a major impact on keeping pubs open, thriving, surviving, but it also having a major impact on jobs. We, through Oxford Economics, have done an independent analysis that says that 4,200 jobs will be protected, but also in addition, they will create 500 jobs, and that's just in 1 year. Across a five-year impact, there would be over 7,000 new jobs created, and many of those, of course, will be in the Lincolnshire area.
Okay, let's open it up a wee bit. David Fox, you're listening to some of those facts and figures and so on. Clearly, you perform your magic at a variety of weddings. Have you performed in pubs at all? Is that...
Very much, yes. Yeah. Funnily enough, I'm performing at a pub reopening. Oh. That's very soon. That's in March. It's a Green King.
Right.
But, of course, the chains can weather the storm better than the independents, can't they, David, as you know yourself. And a lot of my friends who have run independent pubs have now sadly had to close pubs because the smoking ban was a big problem, first of all.
Well, we're not going to get that sort of restored.
I know, we keep away from that today,
but
of course, as you say, the duty, I didn't realise it was so high, so it's very interesting.
People don't realise, you know, they sort of talk about, a price of a pint and they don't realise just how much is paid on duty. But
yes.
Pubs across the board, whether they're independent or chain, they all face the same pressures. And, you know, £1 in every £3 spent in a pub goes directly to the tax man, not just in beer duty, but in a range of other taxes as well, be that business rate. So, you know, overall, pubs always are struggling and always facing this pressure. And that's what we're asking the government to do, is to recognise their cultural and social importance as well as their economic value. You know, these are great social spaces and they bring people together. You know, a pub is a public place. And in the days when public places are closing down, pubs need to be protected and nurtured to allow them to survive and thrive and carry on serving their community.
Okay. Catherine, any thoughts?
Well, I'm just quite interested in the kind of pub as a kind of social area, which, you know, I've been to a few places where there is kind of the idea of like a local pub, and it is very much like a kind of, there's a very strong sense of community. But I don't know, something that I kind of am considering is a kind of need for more social places that aren't so heavily based around alcohol. Do you think that pubs will have to work around kind of people maybe drinking less for kind of health reasons or things like that? What are your thoughts?
I know obviously from the British Beer Alliance you might say, what? No alcohol, where are we going here, Dave? But I mean,
I would agree with that point. I think pubs do have to adapt to meet their local community needs. And that's critical, and I think they are doing a good job at doing that, and they're opening up their spaces, they're holding, you know, yoga sessions, mother and toddler sessions. You can walk into a pub and it's not all about beer and it's not all about alcohol. You can have coffee, teas, plug your laptop in, work there during the day, great food, you can stay overnight, and fantastic range of low and no alcoholic products. So a pub is more than about drinking, it's about bringing people together and serving the community that it's a vital lifeline for. So I would agree with that.
Now, today, I think you're already getting a protest outside Parliament with, I believe, Candice Brown trapped under a giant pint glass. Once you've won British Bake Off, why not trap yourself under a giant pint glass?
Well, importantly, Candice is a publican, so yeah. She runs her own pub, The Green Man, a lovely pub in Bedfordshire. And, yes, the idea of her being trapped and protesting outside Parliament under a giant pint glass is to reflect, obviously, the huge, sort of enormous financial pressures that her pub and other pubs around the country, 48,000 other pubs around the country, are facing. And again, that's why we're asking the government for their support, and we're also asking listeners for support as well. So, you know, please join the more than quarter of a million people now who've signed our petition by going to longlivethelocal.pub and putting your name up there so that people can really understand and politicians can really understand how much we care about pubs and how much we want and need the beer duty cut.
That's right. Candice has been on the programme, and I think the sort of stunt from that point of view would be interesting. Well, I can imagine some commuters sort of thinking, am I drinking? What's going on here? What's happening on this sort of basis? But still. Emily, any thoughts from yourself?
I am actually really interested by this. I completely agree with what Catherine had said earlier. With a pub, it is such a community feel about it. I know that at my pub at home, we often do quiz nights, not just with friends, but with family as well. We do Sunday roasts at pubs on the odd occasion. If I go for a walk with my dog, me and my mum might go for a roast after on a Sunday. So I do think there is a big sense of a social space, and it does have a community feel about it. And I do think it would be a shame if pubs started closing down just because of that extortionate price for beer duty.
I think that's something which we echo from that point of view. And, of course, the classic line, David, from your own point of view, is once they've gone, basically. We, and
absolutely. All sort of use it or lose it. So do visit your local pub. Do enjoy a pint or even a cup of coffee down there. Yeah. But also visit our website, longlivethelocal.pub. Sign the petition.
Absolutely. David, it's been sensational connecting with your good self today. Actually, Emma, did you have any final sort of thoughts from your own point of view as a Lincolnshire lass?
Lincolnshire lass, like it. I think it's opened my eyes a little bit. I don't go to pubs, really. I don't use those local spaces. But I think from now on, I'll try and support my local pubs.
And it's fair to say, David, if you've got Emma on the case, then all will be well with the world. Just finally, David, can you just give us that website again? Where can people go to for Long Live the Local?
Absolutely. It's longlivethelocal.pub. Sign the petition, and you can even write to your MP as well. 130,000 people have also written to their MP. There's still time to protect pubs.
Western Bay, and it serves 100 ships a day. Lonely sailors pass the time away and talk about their homes. And there's a girl in this harbor town, and she works laying whiskey down. They say, brandy, fetch another round. She serves them whiskey and wine. The sailors say, brandy, you're a fine girl.
You're a fine girl.
What a good wife you would be.
Such a fine girl.
Yeah, your eyes could steal a sailor from the sea. Brandy wears a braided chain made of finest silver from the north of Spain. A locket that bears the name of a man that Brandy loved. He came on a summer's day, bringing gifts from far away, but it made it clear he couldn't stay. No harbor was his home. The sailor said, "Brandy, you're a fine girl.
You're a fine girl.
What a good wife you would be.
Such a fine
but my
girl.
Life, my love, and my lady is the sea." Down, Brandy walks through a silent town and loves a man who's not around. She still can hear him say, she hears him say, "Brandy, you're a fine girl.
You're a fine girl.
What a good wife you would be.
Such a fine girl.
But my life, my love, and my lady."
Splendid to see that revives during Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Brandy, you're a fine girl. Looking Glass. It's almost like being back in the 70s again. 1870s? No, 1970s. It's coming around to 27 and a half minutes past 9 o'clock here on Siren Radio. Up next, as promised, we'll be speaking to Sarah Khan, business owner, British television presenter, Loose Women panellist, and Louise Robinson, head of Breakthrough at Santander. Can you name a single female entrepreneur?
Of true love.
There's your trouble, Dixie Chicks. I wonder if they can name actually any single female entrepreneurs. We are delighted to welcome the fabulous Syra Khan back to the programme. Syra, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Excellent. Delighted. I'm sort of reminded, of course, it is Syra, not Sarah. Oh, my Lord.
It's just, Syra.
It's understand. And, of course, Louise Robinson, head of Breakthrough at Santander, also with us. How are you, Louise?
Yes, I'm really good. Thank you, Alex.
Marvellous. In the studio, we've got three fabulous females. We've got all undergraduates at the University of Lincoln. Emily.
Hi, how are you?
Emma.
Hello.
Hi, Emily.
Hello.
And Catherine.
Hello.
And they were racking their brains to find a single female entrepreneur, and they came up with...
Oh, Karen Brady.
Yeah, that's one. Yeah, Karen that's Brady. One. We also have David Fox, I think, magician extraordinaire. And we weren't sure, were we, David, in terms of... I mean, obviously, we're sure about Karen Brady.
Well, but, in terms of celebrity ones, but as I was saying to everyone, that I do know, I have friends, you know, female friends who run businesses, and very successful businesses.
Like Syra Khan.
Well, yes, this is it, of course.
So, Syra, talk to us about this kind of blockage that, you know, here we are, third decade in the 21st century, and we're still having problems when it comes to the whole notion about, you know, 63% of girls aged between 11 and 18 never even thought about starting their own business, basically because they just don't know where to begin.
Well, I do feel a little bit saddened that here in 2020, after the successes of programmes like The Apprentice and Dragon's Den, we are looking at research by Santander that says that most young people cannot name a single female entrepreneur. So they can't name people like Jacqueline Gold, Martha Lane Fox, Coco Chanel, you know, J.K. Rowling, Stella McCartney. You know, these people are household names. And our young girls are failing to even understand that they are entrepreneurs. But more importantly, that actually a lot of parents, more than half of parents, think that entrepreneurship is more suited to men. And I'm really sorry. I'm a woman. I've got a daughter. We can't have this. We've got to do something to change this mindset. Because, you know, to be an entrepreneur, to understand that it is for men as well as women, to have an idea and to make money from it brings enormous joy, contributes to the economy, and actually it's the way of the world. It is the future. So whether you are an artist, whether you're a musician, whether you are an aerobics instructor, whatever you're doing, you can do that for yourself. That is what it means to be an entrepreneur. And it's not a fancy word. It just means starting your own business. And we've got to get that down to our young girls.
Syra, the passion is just
tangible. Yeah, I'm so passionate
wonderful.
About this.
Let's turn to Catherine. Any thoughts for yourself? Because I know you're thinking of doing some postgraduate work when you graduate in a few months' time and so on. What about being an entrepreneur?
I think it's an interesting point that you raised about we don't connect these people with being entrepreneurs. Like, I know, kind of, after you've spoken, I know quite a few women who've, like, run their own businesses, but I don't think of them as entrepreneurs. And I don't know, I struggle in terms of starting my own business. I struggle to see sort of what I would have a business in and how I would go about making it, even if I did have, like, a business idea. But, yeah, I think it's definitely an issue of, when we see women who have these businesses and own these businesses, we still don't connect that entrepreneur label to them.
Yeah. I think a lot of the reason for that is because we don't have the visibility. And also, I think we think this word entrepreneur is like some mysterious thing. It, like I said, it just means that you have an idea and you make money out of it. But can I also say, for me, when I started my journey, I actually went into a corporation first to actually understand how a business works. And then when it suited me and I had the skills and I had the confidence, that's when I thought, you know what, actually to suit my lifestyle, I now need to be doing this on my own, and I feel I can do it better because I've got the skills and knowledge. And I do understand it's daunting, but it's not something that women should think it's not for me. And that's the problem at the moment. They're not being even encouraged to believe that one day they can have their own business.
Emily, how are you inspired? I mean, I feel that Syra has basically sort of just laid the line down from that point of view, and I can almost hear Louise sort of cheerleading in the background and say, yay, yay!
Yeah, I think I am inspired, and I can hear how passionate you are about it as well, which is lovely. But I think I agree with Catherine. Although I could have a business idea in my head, I don't think I'd know where to go from there. So I'm intrigued to know what advice you would give to someone who was a budding entrepreneur, who had enthusiasm about wanting to start a business. What advice would you give them to where to go?
Emily, probably I'd like to try and answer that for you. We come across a great number of young women within Santander who are setting up businesses, and they all say the same thing around, you know, I've got an idea, but I really don't know what to do with it. So what we're trying to do with part of this research is to provide some guidance, if you like, in terms of what the first steps would be if you have an idea and how to bring that idea to market. I think something that Syra's already mentioned in terms of the lack of role models and relatable role models is an issue. And what we're also trying to do is to try and show people, young women who've come through schools, universities, that have started off with a very, very small idea, which has actually begun to snowball. So I think if you're able to look at examples of how businesses or people have brought their ideas together and how they've set those businesses up, that's a great way of being able to look at, if I've got an idea, how do I bring that to the fore? There's a whole lot of help out there. The British Library, for example, they have business and IP centres up and down the country where you can actually go and meet other young women who are putting ideas together. And I think networking, meeting other people that have got ideas and looking at how you can get those ideas off the ground are all welcome things. Louise, can I just also add, I think the practicality side of things, I completely understand. If the school isn't encouraging you, if your parents aren't entrepreneurs and you've got an idea, where do you start? The first stop, and I'll tell you, because I've started two businesses, one did okay and the other one is very successful. First stop, go to your bank. And this is where people like Santander look online, look at their breakthrough program, listen to some of the stories and be inspired. It's not difficult. Go to your bank. Think about your business plan, because that will then help you to understand, okay, what do I need to focus on? And also understand that it will take you time to make money from your business idea. You're not going to become millionaires overnight, and it is hard work. But with the advent of social media, and also the internet, there is so much. Just type in, how do I make my idea into a business? And you will see that there's so much information out there. I mean, much more than when I started sort of 15, 20 years ago. But also, I think the key thing for me, though, is, you know, I can hear the hesitancy. I've got an idea, but I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. And I think it's about having that confidence and that passion to really go for it. Because the help is out there. The infrastructure's from people like Santander are put into place. But I think this is what I find with women and females, is that they have the hesitancy, whereas the men go, I've got an idea, I'm going to go and do something about it. And I think that's part of our obstacle.
Emma.
Because we don't see the role models.
Emma Street, I mean, clearly one of Signet PR's finest here at the University of Lincoln and so on. Are you inspired by what you've heard as a case of, yes, I now know when I graduate in a year and a half or so where I'm going to go?
I am inspired. I'm also quite saddened, really, that there's still young girls growing up now who can't see these role models, and that there are parents as well, like, raising young girls who don't think that, you know, young girls can make it. And it's quite a deep-rooted stereotype, I think, still, that, you know, men are the businessmen, really. What steps do you think we can take to try and combat these stereotypes?
I think there are things that schools can in particular start to do. Sarah and I were talking just before this interview around our own upbringings and the types of schools that we went to, the types of encouragement that, that we had. If schools got more involved in perhaps some of the enterprise schemes, for example, and put forward some of their young women, even if they don't then end up going into self-employment, the skills that you learn going through that type of program really help. And I also found, doing some research for this, one school, only one at the moment, but I'm hoping if we talk about it, more people might do it, a school in Putney that have actually just taken on an entrepreneur in residence. So this person goes into the school to talk to young girls, 11 to 18, around self-employment and entrepreneurship as an idea. And I think that type of thing will really help us change things.
Yeah, and I think your local community is really, really important. And again, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, there are places and institutions out there like Santander who will come into a school and talk about entrepreneurship. But I do think it's our own responsibility. I mean, I'm a parent. I've got two children. Zach's 11 and Mara's 8. And I've actually gone into their school and said to them, what are you doing about entrepreneurship? And they really honestly are blank. So I introduced, right, the next time you do your school fair, I'd like you to give the kids £5, get into groups, I'll come in and I'll talk to them about an idea. They've got £5, the rest of it is about how do you make something out of nothing, are the skills that you need. So I think that grassroots level is really important, but I don't think the schools are capable or equipped to do it by themselves. I think it is parents, and if they've got children, to go in there and really offer their services, because schools are so, they've got so much to do anyway. But, you know, to for parents to go in and say, look, I don't mind coming into assembly and talking about how I started my business. You know, something like that will just spark some kind of motivation or inspiration for a child for the rest of their life, and they'll probably go on and do it. But I think that, you know, the next 10, 15 years, 20 years, it is the years of the women. And I think if we don't feel confident that we can go and do it, and we don't know where to go and find help, we can't pass that on to our local communities. And I think it's about bringing together the institutions that align with our values and what women stand for that we have to start championing.
Sarah, if we could wire you up to the national grid, I mean, I think we'd have all of the energy services put together in one meeting. Indeed. To find out further information, presumably santanderbreakthrough.co.uk/partnership of female entrepreneurs would be the best way to forward.
Yes, please.
Excellent.
I mean, take a look on there. There's a lot of information. There's also a quiz to find out how entrepreneurial you may be.
Well,
and we're also going to be going out into schools and expanding our WorkWise programme, which is what we talk about careers into entrepreneurship as well.
Sounds absolutely sensational. It's been a delight having you both on the programme today. I'm sure.
Go for it, girls.
You've given me the inspiration I need, I think. Yeah.
As I say, David and myself, we'll get our coats and just leave by the side. it's all there. Sarah Kisira Khan and Andrews. Many thanks to you. A round of applause for both these fine folk.
Gonna come and play.
microscopes that magnified the tears. Studied warts and arm, still alive for all and all.
And it's not just a long time ago when she was fab, because she's fab all the time, whether she's dealing with Rip Off Britain, whether she's dealing with Alzheimer's, with all sorts of other wonderful things. It's the awesome Angela Rippon. How are you, Angela?
Good morning to you, Alex. I'm fine.
It's delightful to have you back on the programme, even though I think
you're
a little bit suffering from the sniffles and such like that. We're okay. Yeah. All will be well. All will be well. That's the important thing. We've just had a fascinating little piece with Saira Khan, who I think passionate is an understatement in terms of her views about female entrepreneurs and so on. And just briefly, from your own perspective, Angela, are we redressing the balance, or do you think in some ways the fact that recent survey suggested that very few people can actually name a single female entrepreneur, that maybe actually we've got challenges still to develop?
Well, I know a few female entrepreneurs myself.
Indeed.
And I think the difference is that maybe they there are an awful lot of them who just get on with the job, and they're not necessarily, you know, in Forbes magazine or on the front page of the Financial Times or whatever, but they just get on with the job and do it. And the thing is that I think perhaps a lot of them are young women who are just getting into starting up their own businesses, and maybe they haven't yet had the opportunity of garnering the kind of publicity that means that people are aware of them. But I think if you look at things like women's magazines, Saga magazine, and all sorts of magazines, the Mail at the Weekends, you know, the U magazine, they're very often featuring young women who are doing amazing things in business and giving them the opportunity to get the kind of publicity that they need.
What actually inspired yourself, Angela, to actually go through the journalistic routine, get indentured and work through that and become the legend that we know today?
Sorry, say again?
What inspired yourself in terms of... Oh. Because that's been an underlying theme of the programme. We've been talking about children being read to by their parents, and so we've been talking about various other bits and pieces. We've got three fabulous undergraduates in the studio, and a magician, David Fox, of course, doing wonderful things from that point of view. Was there any particular sort of moment where you thought, yes, this is the one, this is where I'm going to go?
It really, I suppose, started when I was about 5 or 6, I think, when my father gave me a camera. He gave me a little box brownie, because all through the Second World War, my dad had taken photographs. He had a little camera with him all the time. And so I have an album full of photographs of when he was in the desert, when he was on board ships in the Atlantic, when he was in Japan, when he was in China at the end of the Second World War. An entire album full of the things that he saw. And he gave me a camera, and I started taking pictures when I was very little. And I've taken photographs all my life, and I think when I left school, my ambition actually was to be a photojournalist. I wanted to be someone who took photographs and wrote stories to go with them. And I had the opportunity then of joining a newspaper and becoming a journalist. But I did a couple of years in photography on a newspaper beforehand. Then I did my 3-year apprenticeship. So really, I think it started from just wanting to take photographs, working in, if you like, a visual environment. And in a way, even though I had no ambitions at the time to work in television, because we are talking about 53 years ago now, half a century ago, it was a long time ago, my ambition was to be a photojournalist. And if you think about it, television is the ultimate in photojournalism, because it is a combination of words and pictures.
Yeah, very much so. And that, quite frankly, is why the successor to Tony Hall should be Angela Rippon, quite frankly. I mean, there's no answer about it. I think, you know, the campaign should start now.
Just give me the job for 6 months.
Exactly.
That would be enough, thank you very much.
you would streamline the whole, it'd be perfect, it'd be wonderful. Let's open it up to David, actually. David, any thoughts or questions you'd like to share with Angela?
Well, it's lovely to hear Angela Rippon's voice and to the opportunity to chat to her today. Just going back over your career, Angela, is there anyone in particular, I know it's maybe a very tough question for the morning show, who really had a big impact on you? I mean, who would you say, is there maybe any characters that come into mind that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, funnily enough, yes. My very first, he was my major executive producer when I started down at BBC Plymouth. He was a man called Tom Salmon, and he was a wonderful broadcaster. And he just was a mentor to me when I was starting out, because having finished my apprenticeship as a newspaper reporter, I think hopefully that I knew how to interview people, how to write stories. But broadcasting is a rather different technique, of course. And he was just brilliant. And interestingly, I was listening to a program on Radio 4 a couple of mornings ago, and they were talking about the lack of regional voices on radio and television now. And Tom was a classic example of a Cornishman. He came from Truro in Cornwall. He had the most fabulous, if you like, refined Cornish accent, but it was a Cornish accent. And his voice, he had the timbre that was absolutely perfect for radio. And it suddenly occurred to me, yes, I've never heard anybody like Tom on national radio or television for a very, very long time. But he was also a brilliant journalist, and he was a terrific impact on me. And there were also a couple of people that I met when I was at Television News, who, again, were great mentors and really helped in my sort of transition, if you like, from working in regional television and radio to being on the national stage.
Thank us. That's well. Great.
Emily, one of the reasons you came along to Siren, as well as being recommended by one of our Canadian correspondents, was to sort of begin to sort of think about entering the business of media and so on. Any questions or thoughts you'd like to put to Angela?
Yes. Hi, Angela. First of all, it's nice to be able to talk to you.
Thank you.
Like Alex had said, from leaving university, I'm hoping to go into the media aspect, hopefully the production side. When you first started your career, what advice would you give to people who are potentially wanting to go down that same route? Kind of where to go, what support to get, and what kind of experience you need?
Well, interestingly, it's all quite different now from when I started, as I say, over half a century ago, because in a way you had to be a kind of master of all things. And so, yes, I was a journalist and I was learning how to be a broadcaster as well. But at the same time, I was given the opportunity to produce and direct documentaries. And the way that I learned was by working with very good cameramen and very good film editors. Nowadays, I think the route is really quite different. That schooling for me was brilliant because I had people who understood pictures, who understood how to frame a good shot, who knew what it was like to sit in an edit room with a lot of film and really put something together to get the very best effect from it. Nowadays, I think if you want to go into production, there's a rather different route to it. It means joining one of the production... I mean, if you can get onto the BBC training scheme, or you can work for one of the regional BBC or ITV companies, or for one of the now thousands of independent production companies, get in at whatever level you can. And maybe that means being a runner. Maybe that means being a researcher. But to get a job in the industry where you can observe and watch and learn. And a lot of the young people that I work with now, and I say young people, you know, they're now people in their 30s. When they came out of university, that's what they did. They became researchers, so they understood what was required on a story, you know, what was good information, what was bad information, what was the sort of stuff that would really make an interesting program. They would then be able to go out on location and see people working, see how the cameramen worked,
it's not
see
good.
How the directors worked. And you actually get training on the job. And that's really the best way to do it, because if you have access, as it were, to a lot of different jobs in broadcasting, you can actually see the ones that really fire your own imagination. And maybe you go in wanting to be, I don't know, a senior researcher. Or maybe you think, no, actually what I want to be is a producer, or what I want to be is a director, or what I want to do is something entirely different in broadcasting. I think it's being able to have that amazing range of opportunities that there are in broadcasting now, and being exposed to them, it gives you an idea of what you genuinely want to do, and more importantly, I think, what you have a real passion to do. And sometimes you may surprise yourself. You may see somebody doing something and thinking, I never thought of it. That's what I want to do.
It's like a Pre-Seek Broadcasting Masterclass in an audio form. Emma Street, any thoughts from yourself?
Exactly.
Well, let's turn quickly to Catherine. I mean, last night, of course, Catherine speaking to Annette Andre over in San Diego, connecting with that one now, Angela Rippon. It's just for that point of view. Any thoughts?
Yeah. I was just reading a recent letter that was published in the Yorkshire Post, I believe, about kind of making buses more Alzheimer's and dementia friendly and public transport in general. And I was just wondering, how have you kind of incorporated this sort of activist work, I suppose, or raising awareness for dementia and Alzheimer's? How do you incorporate that into your career? How do you kind of go from point A to point B in raising awareness of these things?
Well, I started because my late mother, Edna, she had vascular dementia. So I had one of those very sharp learning curves where being confronted by someone who had dementia, having to really sort of understand the disease and to be able to understand it in a way that was the best way to help my mother. And as a result, I became an ambassador for the Alzheimer's Society, which helped to increase my knowledge considerably. But for the last 6 years, I've co-chaired the Prime Minister's group on dementia-friendly communities. And that's it's a movement which helps to make people throughout the country, through things like Dementia Friends and all of the various things that we do with various aspects of business and community life, to make people or to help people become much more aware of what dementia is, how it affects people, how you can help someone who has dementia or be supportive to the family of someone who has dementia. And through the committee that promotes dementia-friendly communities, what we've been able to do is to get all sorts of organizations understand how they can help those people. Because, you know, if you have dementia, you are going to forget things. You are going to get a bit confused. You are going to have moments where perhaps, you know, you're not quite certain of what you're doing. And as a result, you can become very frustrated and have an outburst. So we're dealing, one of the areas in which we're dealing is with public transport. Because an awful lot of people with dementia, particularly those in the early stages, still like to be incredibly independent. And so they still want to travel. They want to go by taxi or bus or underground or train. And so it's really important that the staff who man those transport outlets are aware that if they come up against someone who is being really confused and perhaps being a bit difficult, if they can recognize that this is because of dementia, it's fear on the part of the dementia person as much as anything, that they're going to get lost, that they're going to suddenly find themselves at the wrong place. All of that, helping to give staff a dementia awareness, means that instead of perhaps getting short with them and thinking that they're just another troublemaker, they'll actually understand what the situation is and be really, really helpful to ensure that that person really gets the best kind of support that they possibly can from that group of staff. I mean, you know, we've done it with banking, we've done it with insurance, we've done it with telecommunications, we've done it with supermarkets. For instance, people who are the Tesco delivery drivers, they're all being trained in dementia awareness because they get to see people in their homes. And they're very often some of the first people to realize that, you know, someone with dementia has just perhaps, I don't know, made four deliveries in a week when they didn't really need it. And also, very often people with dementia are isolated and lonely. And this is an opportunity for a delivery driver, a postman, someone who is a bus driver or whatever, just to have to make personal contact with someone so that they don't feel quite so isolated and they realize that they are being helped. So, yeah, that's one of the really, and particularly with rural communities, a bus driver or a taxi driver is a main link for that individual with the rest of society. So ensuring that they understand what dementia is and how to help someone with dementia or their family is really a terribly important way of ensuring that community does not remain isolated.
Angela, on a programme which has actually taken us from Richard Fitzwilliam's views on Portrait of a Lady on Fire and Greed through best-selling children's author Jenny McLachlan, Ian Lennox from Newcastle, Dr Claire O'Donnell, Alex Short discussing eye care, David Cunningham on Britain's beer alliance and the fact that actually today is where Britain has actually paid as much beer duty in the first 2 months of 2020 as Germans will all year. I know that could be a feature on Rip Off Britain, but you know, we'll step away from that. It's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self and a fabulous way to wrap up the production today. In the studio, of course, Emma Street, Catherine Dove, Emily Boston and David Fox. Thank you. David, do you want to briefly actually just promote your own little charity that you've got coming up in, because you're doing another event, I think, with George Orwell?
Well, that's at the moment, that's in the kind of in the back burner. But yes, I'm always out and about. I mean, I have been doing a bit of fundraising for Maggie's, the Cancer Centre in Nottingham, recently. They do a fantastic job helping people as well.
Time is of the essence. We're heading up to the U-Short. The Angela, two final questions for your good self. You know what they are. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
As always, Alex, yes, of course.
And can we look forward to, obviously, when you get to a full health again, not the coronavirus, please, no, not the coronavirus. Will you be
it's just straightforward bad flu, I'm afraid.
Will you come back and join us again?
I'd love to, and hooray. Hopefully my brain will not be quite so foggy.
Oh, absolutely. A round of applause for Angela Ruffin, please. Hooray! And let's say, frankly, to everybody else, have a fantastic Thursday.
Have a fantastic Thursday.
Have a fantastic Thursday.